Well, we welcome your comments. We welcome your questions. If you don't mind, when you raise your hand, so everybody can hear and I don't have to repeat and maybe not make them as accurately as you would. Lowell's got a mic and they'll try to get that to you. Our topic up here is the end times. Last night we talked about several things, but in particular we talked about how there is only going to be one resurrection. And some of the passages that we used for that was John chapter 5, verses 28 and 29, which says, "In the same hour, both the righteous and the unrighteous will be raised." There won't be multiple resurrections. Acts chapter 24, verse 15, I don't think I turned to that, I will tonight, also references that. We don't use that as often. But it's important for us to have in mind and have scriptures to support one resurrection, because many of the false thoughts about the end of times is that there will be multiple resurrections. There'll be the resurrection of those in the kingdom of the church called the rapture, and then later Christ will come and there'll be the resurrection of the rest. But that is not what I find in the scriptures. In Acts chapter 24, verse 15, it also says, "And have hope toward God, which they themselves also allow, and there shall be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and the unjust." Having the just and the unjust resurrected in a singular moment, if you will, in that singular twinkling of an eye that Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. And then we spent a little bit of time going through a little pedantic exercise, but the three words for the end of time are the last days. Parousia, which we talked about, which talks about the presence or the arrival of Christ. And then there was apocalypsis, which is an unveiling or sometimes translated revealed. And then the third one was epiphania, which is the concept of bringing forth light. And we talked about how those appear to be three different words, but three different descriptive terms of the same event. So when Christ returns, there will be his arrival, the unveiling or the revealing of his ultimate glory, and the revelation of his being and that light. So we talked about those things last night, and then we went into a discussion that I want to continue a little bit tonight about the concept of, are things getting better? And I had several good comments, not unexpected, but several good comments after class as I was talking to various ones, and I thought that it would be good to spend a little bit more time on that. I made the comment last night, and I still think I believe it, that I don't know that things are worse now than they have ever been, but this worseness seems to be somewhat cyclic, and it certainly appears to me that we as a human race are on a downward part of that cycle. Things seem to be worse morally, ethically, religiously than possibly they were when most of us were growing up. It's hard to quantify. I don't know that I think that they are worse than the days of Sodom and Gomorrah. I don't know that I think they are worse than I don't think they were worse than when God destroyed the earth with the flood, because we only had 10 righteous souls out of 200 or 300 million, probably. And hopefully, I think we have good reason to think that there's more than that today. But it does seem to be a devolution. And when you think about a lot of the theories and a lot of the things that we talk about and have studied that have led to this, some of them, at least to me, seem to be trying to convince us that things are getting better. Evolution, for instance. One of the premises of evolution is we're evolving continually to a better state. We're getting better in every various aspects and survival of the fittest. I don't think that's necessarily true. If I had to guess, the people in Genesis were healthier than we are. Certainly they lived longer than we do, but I suspect they were healthier than we are, because a lot of the diseases had not manifested themselves. A lot of the genetic mutations that can lead to difficulties, whether they be disease or deformities, maybe hadn't reared their heads as much. So I suspect that's not true. The age of reason, teaching us that The more we reason in our own minds, the better things are going to get. Well, that obviously probably is not true. Modernism, which says as our technology grows, we will become better. Well, our technology has grown, but I don't know that that has had a positive impact on us spiritually. And then we talked how, despite whether our society is getting better or not, and despite whether you or I think it is, that's not irrelevant because it does impact us, but the real gem of this is that we can morally progress. We can grow spiritually. And the Bible is full of scriptures that indicate that. I was thinking last night, and I had kind of forgotten this, but I went back and looked through some old notes I had. And I remember reading an article that was written in 1959, and there was a line that I wrote down. It said, "Christianity is the supreme champion of purity." I don't know how true that was in 1959. I wasn't very old, but it struck me, and I wrote that down because I asked myself, is that still true? Is Christianity supremely the champion of purity? Is Christianity the champion of moral progress? Well, in 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 1, Paul writing to Timothy tells us that in the latter days, things aren't going to go terribly well, at least morally and ethically and spiritually. Pretty famous passage that you'll probably recognize as I read it. "Now the Spirit speaketh expressly that in the latter times some shall depart from the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of the devil, speaking lies and hypocrisy, having their conscience seared with a hot iron." And you could read on into verses 3 and 4. But verse 1 gives some really chilling predictions about the latter times. People are going to depart from the faith. Well, that started happening pretty quickly after the church was established. "Giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of devils." I believe all false doctrine comes from Satan. And exactly how those thoughts get placed in people's minds, or whether they welcome those thoughts into their minds, I know they have a choice. But I don't know where false teaching and teachings that are not conducive to purity and morality, I don't know where those ideas would come from, other than from Satan and from hell. They don't come from God. They don't come from His Word. So by process of elimination, I've concluded that that is where they come from. Now we have a choice as to whether we dwell on them and manifest them and remain pure or not. But I thought I wanted to spend a little bit more time this evening talking about this concept of moral progression or progress. Peter Sorokin, who was a sociologist at Harvard, he happened to be Russian-born, but I don't know that that's really too relevant, wrote an article in 1961, just a couple of years after that other article I referenced. I just want to read you a paragraph. I thought he did a masterful job in presenting this. He said, "There has been a growing preoccupation with our writers with the social sewers, broken homes of disloyal parents, unloved children, bedroom of the prostitutes, a Cannery Row brothel, and a den of criminals, street combers, and a gang of delinquents, hate-laden prisons, the courtroom of the dishonest judge, the sex adventures of urbanized cavemen." I don't like that phrase, but I like that phrase because it seems so descriptive. The sex adventures of urbanized cavemen. I'm not sure that's too far from where some in our society are. The lovers of adulterers, fornicators, masochists, sadists, mistresses. All of these, he said, have seductively been prepared and served with all the trimmings. And that last sentence, I thought of 1 Timothy 4:1, the seducing spirits. He says, all of those things have been seductively prepared and served with all the trimmings. Now, he wrote that roughly 50 years ago. I suspect it hasn't gotten any better. And when many of us were growing up, finding access to pornography and so forth, I hope we didn't go looking for it, but it wasn't easily found. That's my point. Today, all you have to do is have a cable and a dish, or a cable or a dish, and I'm not saying you shouldn't have those things. It's just so much more readily accessible. And when we compare kind of where we're at with the clamor, and some of you maybe can remember this, I can't. In 1939, there was a movie that came out, Gone with the Wind. And there was a four-letter word in that that just turned everybody, or no, turned many people upside down. I'm not going to say it, but it was D-A-M-N. And what a change between then and today. Mike and I were talking last night as I got to their home, and I don't remember who first said it. It wasn't he or me, but today our society really has lost the ability to blush. I'm not sure that people didn't do these things previously, but what could you and I really see that, or what could many people in our society see that would cause them to blush? It goes along a little bit with what A.W. Tozer said about God when he said, we have lost the awe. You know, when people think of God, there isn't this awe, this reverence that there used to be. Well, I think when we think about sin and we're so caught up in it that, or we're so surrounded with it, I don't want to say caught up in it, I hope that's not the case, but so surrounded with it, it gets to be, we get desensitized. And I think that's sad, I think it's unfortunate, and I think it leads to this devolution of ethics, morals, and immorality. The church of the first century had a lot of problems, and there probably were exceptions to what I'm going to say, but I believe in essence, the first century church, as the Lord established it, was morally pure. And that's something that we probably struggle with a little bit today. It's awful easy to, when we're so surrounded with it, to let it creep in to even God's kingdom, the church. I'm going to turn to 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, and I want to read just a few verses. Then I'll pause and see if anybody has a comment or a question. But in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, we'll be looking at the latter part of this chapter later when we discuss the rapture. But I'm interested right now in the first four or five verses. Paul says in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, Furthermore, we beseech you, brethren, and exhort you by the Lord Jesus Christ, that as you have received of us how you ought to walk, how you ought to conduct yourselves, and to please God, you should abound or do it more and more. For ye know what commandments we gave you by the Lord. In other words, we told you how the Lord wants you to conduct yourself. And this is the will of God. Whenever somebody says, I wonder what God's will is for me, this verse always pops into my head and I go there. This is the will of God, even your sanctification, being set apart from all this garbage, that you should abstain from sexual impurity, fornication, that every one of you should know how to possess and present his vessel, his body, in sanctification and in honor, not in the lust of concupiscence or immorality. Now, the Thessalonians may have been struggling with this. That may be why Paul had to exhort them in this passage. But this is a passage for us also. The concept of possessing means to control. And Paul is saying, learn how to control yourselves so that you are pure. And this would be ethically pure, morally pure, sexually pure. Learn how to control yourselves. Paul said in Romans chapter 12, verse 2, present your bodies a living sacrifice. You know, we have a soul, spirit, and a body. God's not simply interested in our soul and spirit because they are intertwined. He's also interested in our bodies. He says in Romans 6, 12 and 13 that our members, our bodies are to be instruments of righteousness. It's to be the temple of the Holy Spirit, 1 Corinthians 6, 19. It's to glorify God. Sirkin, again, that I quoted to you early, a little bit later in that article, I want to share with this paragraph with you before I kind of wrap this segment up. He said, through the use of drugs, the addict strives to relieve his painful tensions and experience an intense form of sensual pleasure. The more one uses drugs, the deeper he is caught by their chemicals. The more he uses them, the more they change his total personality. And we've probably seen people for which that's true. He said, sexual addiction does not represent an exception to the rules. Dedication of an individual to the pursuit of sexual pleasures means the growth of that desire at the expense of others, radically changing and dominating their whole behavior. And I don't think that simply applies to sexual addiction. Any kind of addiction to immorality or unethicalness drives our whole personality so that we become different people. And sometimes we do things that we would have never dreamt we would have gotten caught up in. And the Bible exceptionally and frequently warns us of these things. Now, in many respects, I think the Lord's church does a good job with this, but I think it continues to be a challenge, and it's not always a good job that is done. But I want to remind myself, and I want to remind all of us tonight, that if I drift, if I sin, it is my fault, not yours. And if you drift, and if you sin, it is your fault, not mine. That doesn't mean we don't have accountability to one another. It doesn't mean we shouldn't help one another, but our ultimate accountability to the Lord is ourselves. And we make willful decisions each day about our lifestyle. And we may say yes, no, maybe, not yet, not at all, never, always. But all of those decisions collectively set the tone for our morality or our immorality. So I thought it was worth at least talking. I felt the need to talk a little bit more about that because I didn't want to leave that subject with the thought that I think we are doing better. I don't think we're doing better. I don't necessarily think we are worse than other facets of history, but I think we're in a cyclic thing. The book of Judges is all about immoral cycles, and I think we are definitely on the downward cycle, and I don't know where it will end. Maybe it will bounce back. Maybe Christ will come before it bounces back. I don't know. But where society is in that cycle isn't near as important as where we are at in that cycle. Paul wrote from the city of Corinth, where he saw homosexuality and fornication and orgies present in the city. I don't know that he viewed them personally, but they were there, and yet he remained pure. And he did some of his most wonderful work under those settings. And it seems like that's the goal he's given us. I'm going to pause now and see if anybody has a comment on or a question on that. I don't know that you will, but I don't think we're in a great shape. And I think the Lord could come tomorrow based upon 1 Timothy chapter 4 because we've certainly accomplished all of those things, the seducing spirits and the doctrines of devils and the loss of our morality. And as a group, let us not lose it as a church or as the kingdom. Okay. That's a good one for us to just kind of think about and not one that we all want to jump up and make a comment about. I understand that. But those of you, us that are, well, all of us in the church, but especially those of us that maybe are a little more mature or maybe, I don't know if I'd say the pillars, I don't consider myself one, but some of you are, we've got a real responsibility here because the world is cascading in the other direction. And I don't know how to teach these kids what the Bible says about this if we don't live it in our lives, because they're going to do what they see more than what they hear. Okay. We also talked a little bit about the Islamic threat, and I don't have much more to say about this. I thought about taking 15 minutes and talking about that religion, but I don't know that that's really conducive to what I'd like to cover tonight. I do consider it a threat, and I thought later, well, maybe I acted like I didn't. But I think it's controllable. And even if it's not, we can control ourselves. But I don't want to take the position that we shouldn't be concerned about it. And there may be opportunities when we can stem that tide, because it is a false religion. They don't even really believe in the same God you and I believe. They talk about Allah and the one God and go back to Abraham. But, you know, when they talk about God, they don't really mean it quite in the way that you and I hope, mean it. They believe in Jesus, but they don't believe he's the Son of God. There's passages in the Quran that are very peaceable. And there are passages in the Quran that, for instance, one of them is they can believe in a tit for a tat, an eye for an eye. That's still a valid premise of theirs. And I don't find that in Christianity. I find it in the Old Testament. I don't find it in the New Testament. So it is something that we ought to be aware of. And in specific examples, you may have an opportunity to thwart it. Do I think that's a sign of the end times? No, I don't necessarily think that any more than I think Hitler was, or the Iron Curtain, or the Berlin Wall, but it is a significant element of the movement that's transpiring today. Does anybody want to ask a question or make a comment on our discussion about Islam last night? I'll give you a chance, because we did kind of run out of time last night. Okay. We talked a little bit last night about Harold Camping, who was the most recent person to give us May 21st as the end of the world. That didn't happen. October 21st, I can't say it won't happen, but I suspect that it won't. And it can cause the skeptic to have an additional tool in his arsenal to snicker at Christianity. But Harold Camping's by far not been the first. He's not been the first, and he's not been the last. Joseph Smith, I mentioned him last night. I told you I thought the date was 1892 or 3. It actually is 1891, is when he predicted the earth would Jesus would come. Well, that didn't happen. C.T. Russell, who was the founder of Watchtower, he predicted 1914. Again, that didn't happen. More recently, Hal Lindsey wrote a book, and he predicted 1988. And he got his number, if I recall, from Matthew chapter 24, which we're going to go to in just a little bit. But in Matthew 24, it says, "These things shall not pass until these." You'll see these things before this generation passes. I'm paraphrasing. And he took a generation to be 40 years. And so he went back and took 1948 for the establishment of Israel, the Jewish state in Israel, added 40 years to that and said it's got to have to happen before 1988. Well, obviously, it did not happen then. And he was also misunderstanding Matthew chapter 24, in my estimation. But these things come and go, and I think we're all wise enough and we've seen them enough to know that we just need to be ready. And not worry about the when, just worry about us. I want to go now and spend probably the rest of the evening and maybe part of tomorrow evening on two passages, or maybe all of tomorrow evening. I want to talk now about Matthew chapter 24, which I think is one of the most difficult passages in the Bible. And then, and I know I won't get to that tonight, I want to look at Romans chapters 9, 10, and 11. And the question that we'll be dealing with probably tomorrow night is, does the nation of Israel have a special place in God's jurisdiction, or has the church replaced the nation of Israel today? The latter is what they call replacement theology, and there's a lot of people that believe Jesus will return and the nation of Israel will dominate in Jerusalem again, and that will be a sign of Christ's coming. We'll talk about that tomorrow night probably. But let's go to Matthew, if you have your Bibles. I want to go to Matthew chapter 24 and look through that and do a little exegesis on that. I don't apologize for it being tedious. I just don't know any other way to go through Matthew 24 without doing it somewhat that way. And it's an important passage because it's a passage that the premillennialists use to support the fact that they believe Jesus Christ is going to come back and establish his kingdom. Before we start on Matthew 24, though, does anybody have a comment or a question on anything we've talked about so far, last night or tonight, that you would like to interject or ask a question about before I start through this? I hope you brought your Bibles. If you didn't, you can simply listen on, and that's fine. But it will be easier, and I will be referencing particular passages as we go through this. In Matthew chapter 24, and again, I hope you have studied this, but it remains a very difficult passage. His disciples asked Jesus two very pertinent questions. I'm going to read the first two verses. Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said unto them, "See you not all these things?" He said, "Look at the temple. You see it?" He says, "Verily I say unto you," or this is a fact, "there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." And then in verse 3, they ask him two questions. And as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately, saying, question number 1, "Tell us, when shall these things be?" In other words, when is the temple going to be destroyed? Number 2, "And what shall be the sign of your coming and of the end of the world?" Well, obviously that second question ties into what we're studying here. What shall be the sign of your coming and the end of the world? But we need to look at this chapter in its totality, because if you miss the point that two different questions are asked, you might conclude that Matthew chapter 24 is all about the second coming of Christ and the end of the world. It is not all about that. The first part of Matthew 24 is Jesus answering the first question about the destruction of the temple. The latter part of the chapter is about him answering some questions and giving some insights into the end of time and his second coming. Now, the difficulty of this chapter, if it was just like that, I don't think it would be a terribly difficult chapter. What makes this chapter, I think, difficult for me in many instances is that beginning in verse 28 until about verse 35, he commingles his answers. And so sometimes in those verses he's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple, and sometimes I think he shifts over to the end of time. And then beginning in verse 34, 35, he then pretty much is predominantly just talking about the end of time. And so it does make it a little bit more difficult as we go through this. Now, the Jews may have really thought they were only asking him one question, because they may well, in fact, I suspect they thought the temple would be destroyed at the end of time. Nothing was going to destroy the temple until Jesus came. That may very well, in fact, probably was their mindset. And so Jesus has to explain to them, now these are two different events. The destruction of the temple, or Jerusalem, and we know historically that occurred in AD 70 when the Roman army, led by Titus, destroyed Jerusalem and tore down the temple. And the second coming. So what he has to do, or what he does here, is give us two answers because of two questions. Now, I'm going to go through this kind of in a summary fashion. Then we'll go back and look at it a little bit more closely. But Jesus gives them a series of warnings, clues, signs of when Jerusalem, the temple, would fall. And that begins in verse 5 and goes through verse 14. There are roughly 9 or 10 things he says, now you look for these, and when these occur, then it's getting close. But remember again, he's still talking about the destruction of the temple. And I think I can prove that in just a moment. But let me give you the 9 or 10 things he says to be watchful for. First of all, in verse 5, "For many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many." One of the things that was going to happen before Jerusalem and the temple was destroyed is people would come and say, I'm Christ. False messiahs. He says, that's going to be one of the signs. Secondly, in verse 6, there's going to be rumors of wars. Well, this has happened multiple times, not just for the destruction of Jerusalem. But that was going to be one of them. Verse 7. Nation shall rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines and pestilence, earthquakes and diverse. There's going to be a lot of natural catastrophes in this 40 years from the time Christ gave this prediction until 70 AD, when it actually took place. There'll be persecutions. Verses 8 and 9. That's the fourth one he gives them. All these things are the beginning of sorrows, and they then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. Next, verse 10, there'll be departing from the faith. There'll be stumbling. And then many shall be offended, and shall betray one another, and shall hate one another. In other words, there'll be difficulties within the Lord's people. Verse 11, false prophets, and many false prophets shall arise and deceive many. Now, I could take that verse and apply it to today. In fact, I could probably take every sign so far I've given and apply it to today. And I can understand why people would go down these and say, well, that's happening. Oh, we just had a tsunami. We just had Joplin got wiped off. We just had this fires in Arizona, and all these things are happening. And maybe this is the end of the time, but I think we're going to see that that's not what he's talking about as we go through this. Number 7 is in verse 12. And because of sin shall abound, the love of many shall wax old. People are going to quit caring about one another. Verse 13. But those who endured shall be or will be delivered. I don't know that I can prove this, but history seems to indicate that no Christians died in the downfall of Jerusalem. Now, I want to believe that. I don't know. The Bible doesn't tell us that. But several historical, Josephus and various historical beings seem to indicate that. And if that's the case, we've got a real wonderful example of the providential mercy of God. Next, in verse 14, he says, the gospel will be spread during this time. But the real crown, now we get into why I'm convinced this is not talking about now, but is talking about then, and it's not talking about the end time. When we get to verse 15 through 19, in verse 15, when ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation. Now, where in the Bible have we found the phrase abomination of desolation? Somebody besides Mark, because he's taught it. Daniel. Okay. What is the abomination of desolation a reference to? You remember from your studies? That would have been an abomination. I think that's not exactly what he's talking about here. That was an abomination. But going back to Daniel, I don't think that's the specific reference. Well, the abomination, that was a Gentilic reference. The desolation was a military reference, and I think it's a reference to a Gentilic, a Gentile military power, i.e. the Roman army. And that we get that from the book of Daniel also. So I think he's saying that the ultimate sign is going to be this impending invasion of a Gentile army. And nothing would be more of an abomination to the Jews than be beaten by a Gentile army. Now, Lowell's reference to Antiochus Epiphanes placing a pork on the altar, about 160 years B.C., would certainly be an abomination, and it would be a Gentile abomination. But in terms of 70 A.D., I think this is a reference to the army. Now, having said that, let me share with you why I prove to myself, and then you obviously make your own mind, that this is not talking about now. It is talking about then. Look in verse 15. When ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in where? The holy place. Now, what would that be? That would be Jerusalem or the temple. Remember, it had the holy and the most holy. Des Moines doesn't have, in God's terms, the holy place. Kansas City doesn't. Let's go down a little bit further. Well, let me just make a don't go further, just listen. Luke chapter 21, verse 20 also is talking about this same event. And in Luke 21 and 20, Luke says this, "And when you shall see Jerusalem compassed about with armies, then you shall know that the desolation is nigh." So that just reinforces this abomination of desolation being the army. But he says, when you shall see Jerusalem surrounded by it. He didn't say when you shall see New York or Paris or Moscow or Pleasant Hill or Lee Summit. He said Jerusalem. You know, another reference that tells us he's talking about then and not now. Verse 16, "Then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains." Well, I'm not in Judea. You're not in Judea. He's talking to the people of Judea that flee into the mountains. And Jerusalem was on a mountain. Okay? So now we've got a geographical mooring, if you will. Verse 17, "Let him which is on the housetop come not down." Now you remember how they built their houses back then, and their housetops would be kind of like our patios or decks. And occasionally I'll see someone with a house like that, but at home when we're going to barbecue, Donna doesn't say go get on the roof and do the hamburgers for two reasons. Number one, there's nothing up there to cook with. And number two, my nose would start bleeding so bad that it wouldn't work. But it's a cultural description, getting up on the housetops. Just bear with me a couple of more points. Verse 20, "But pray you that your flight not be in the winter." Well, he can't be talking to the people in Cairo, because he's talking about winter because of the cold and the snow. And then in the latter part of verse 20, "neither on the Sabbath." So I know he's not talking about now, because the Sabbath is not an issue for the Lord now. So when you take all of those things together, it seems to me like it's obvious that this is a prediction about the destruction of the temple and not the end of time. Now I spent quite a bit of time trying to convince us or prove to us or help us understand that these verses, certainly down as we go down through 27, are about the destruction of Jerusalem. Don't take those verses and try to apply it to the end of time. That's the point I'm trying to make. And the premillennialists do exactly that. They say these are signs that Jesus is coming. No, these are signs that Jerusalem and the temple are going to be destroyed. Okay? They are not signs of Jesus coming. Okay, in fact, if you'll skip with me just a little bit further down to verse 36, now I think he's talking about the end of time, and he has that famous verse, "But of that day and hour knoweth no man, not even the angels are in heaven, but my Father only." And Jesus seems to indicate that he didn't even know, at least during his earthly ministry. But he's gone to great lengths to give all these 10 signs of, so that they'll know when it's going to happen, so they can flee before the destruction, so that the saints can flee before the destruction of Jerusalem and before. But when we get to the second coming of Christ, it's talked about as a thief in the night, and words like suddenly, immediately, and nobody's going to know. Quite a different setting. So as we go through Matthew 24, please, as you study this, try to keep in mind that at least down through verses 27 and 28, it's a strict reference to, pardon me, the end of the temple and the end of Jerusalem, not to the end of time. Now there are some passages for which it is used in that way, but not necessarily for the end of time. I'm going to pause because that's a little pedantic, but I think it's important as we went through that. Does anybody have a comment or a question on what those verses, the first part of this chapter, are referring to, or maybe a different take or something you've thought about? You got Suzanne there.
Can you give some more comment about why this area of 36 on would not also be about when Jesus is crucified?
When he is crucified?
Or when he is coming back.
I think from 36 on, it is then starting to talk about when Jesus, that is talking about when Jesus comes back.
But you're talking about the end, you mentioned that you thought it was the end of time.
I think Jesus coming back and the end of time are synonymous.
Okay, but could this not be, when he's talking to these people at that time,
mm-hmm.
how could they have deciphered what verses up through 28 were, the destruction of Jerusalem, and then switching to verse 36 talking about the end of time? Can you comment some more about why you feel that that's the end of time versus when Christ would possibly during his time on earth or returning back to the Father, something like that?
Okay, I'll try. I'm not sure I totally got my arm around your question, but let me make a few comments. How would these people have known? I'm not sure that was all your question, but I think they probably remembered, hey, we ask him a couple of questions, and we sometimes forget that they ask him a couple of questions. Well, when you ask two questions, you ought to be ready for two answers. But he did have a challenge, if I can put it that way, of trying to get them to see that the destruction of the temple was not synonymous with the end of time. And as I said, I think they may have thought that. And when we look at, well, look at verse 29, for instance, Suzanne. I hadn't gotten there. He's been talking about the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. And then he says in verse 29, then immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, the moon shall not give her light, the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. I think that verse is saying, at that time, the Jewish nation will no longer be as it's been before. I think verse 29 is saying there's going to be an end to the Jewish nation of Israel as it had been up until then. And then in verse 30 he says, then after that, a sequential concept, shall appear the Son of Man in heaven. That now is the second coming. He's saying, well, this is all going to happen to Jerusalem. And then sometime after that, then, we don't know how long, but sometimes after that, then he goes in verse 30 and 31 to a discussion of the second coming of Christ. And if you look at verse 31, you get a real emphasis on the second coming, because it says, he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four corners or from all parts of the earth, from the one end of heaven to the other. Verse 31 is very similar to the wordage we have in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 when it says Jesus will come with his angels and a trump. And that's a passage on the rapture that we'll probably study maybe Thursday night. But I'm not at all trying to convince you that this is an easy chapter. I wouldn't have taken this much time, and for a long time I didn't even teach this chapter because I didn't know what it said. I didn't know what I thought it said. Let me rephrase that. I think I now know what it says, but it is a difficult chapter. Now, I'm not sure I answered your question, Suzanne, so don't let me not answer it if I can grasp it. Or you want to think about it? Okay. No, I didn't do that. I talked about it. We got one up here, and I don't know where else. Wanda's got one. Just a minute. Now.
Oh. Matthew 24, 4 through the 26th verse is the destruction of the temple and Jerusalem, correct?
That's my understanding, yes. Based upon the fact that it's talking about things that are culturally and time-wise specific to that era.
Not all scholars, I think, a lot of them seem to agree with you, because my Thompson Chain Reference Bible, 1769, calls this the destruction of Jerusalem Temple in this chapter. Its headings listed that way. The first part of this says the destruction of Jerusalem, the temple in Jerusalem.
Okay, well, you're certainly right. Not all scholars agree with me. That part is definitely true. But it works. I can't make it work any other way. Sometimes you have to figure out what it's not saying, and then that helps you figure out what it is saying. Mike?
Have you read anything about the abomination of desolation referring to a specific Roman commander?
To a specific what?
Roman commander.
Well, I think the leader was Titus. Do you have a thought on that?
Is that his name? I couldn't remember his name.
Titus was the military leader in 70, I believe.
I've read history and commentary that says the abomination of desolation in this reference right here referred to a specific Roman commander. But I couldn't remember his name.
I wasn't going to argue that point. I've always taken it to be a reference to the Roman army that encompassed Jerusalem based upon Luke 21:20 that I read for you.
Okay.
But they obviously had specific leaders. But I haven't taken that. I haven't pursued that. Does anybody have a thought on that? Maybe somebody has studied that and gleaned something out of that would be worthwhile. So if I schematically did Matthew 24, I believe verses, say, 4 through 27 are the temple or Jerusalem destruction. How shall I do this? 36 and following are the end of time. And then we've got this series of verses, say 28 through 34, 35, where there is a commingling. And he's making a transition from one to the other. But these are the verses that I find to be the most difficult, because you have to kind of sort out in your own thought which he's talking about. For instance, I said I'm confident that verse 29 is a destruction of Jerusalem. And I'm going to give you these passages, and then I'll give them to you more tomorrow night, but some of you may not be back. But in verse 29, this darkening of the sun, the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, that all sounds like a cataclysmic event that would fit the end of time. But when you go back to Old Testament prophecy in Isaiah chapter 13, verse 10, those same terms are used for to describe the downfall of Babylon. What I think verse 29 is talking about is not the cataclysmic downfall of the end of time, it's the cataclysmic downfall of a nation. Just like in Isaiah chapter 13, it was the downfall of Babylon. In Joel chapter 3, these terms are used for the downfall of Egypt. Here in Matthew 24, God is consistent, and he uses the darkening of the sun and the moon and the falling of the stars to signal a downfall of a nation. And I believe this was the downfall of the nation of Israel, which will impact my interpretations of Romans 9, 10, and 11, because I take Israel today to be the church. Now, there is a nation of Israel, but I think in terms of Israel was God's people, the church today is God's people, and I'll talk more about that when I get to Romans 9, 10, and 11. And you don't have to agree with me, but I will present my thoughts on that. Marvin? Just a minute. One more time.
I think what confuses us all is that these same words were used to describe the crucifixion of Christ.
Okay.
But not with the same result.
You see that in Acts chapter... that's not Acts chapter 2, but you do see it in... But there again, you've got the downfall in some way of a power and the resurrection of a new kingdom. Okay. But when it was in reference to the crucifixion, maybe we're getting back to Suzanne's question a little bit better. It was a tremendous shift and change in power. whether it was Babylon going down, Egypt going down, Israel going down, or the church being established vis-a-vis the crucifixion. It was a tremendous change in power. But they were not used as descriptive for the end of time. That's a point that I think is important. Otherwise, you take these signs as signs of the end of time. And that's what people do. They'll say, well, we're looking for this, this, and this. But as we're going to see a little bit later in this chapter, he says there will be no sign for the coming of the Lord. If there's a bunch of signs for Jesus' second coming, how is he going to come as a thief in the night when we're not expecting him? If we can just check off. If I believe that Israel has to occupy Jerusalem again and the temple has to be rebuilt before Christ can come back, then I don't have to look for him because he can't come yet because there is no temple rebuilt. I don't believe that, but I wouldn't look for him. Now, I'd still be concerned about my life because I could go and see him. I mean, I could die. But I don't accept that thought process. Tom, and I'm going to ring the bell, but you go ahead and make your comment. I forgot to call the kids up last night. I just leave them there. They'll come.
Just some observations about this end of time thing. From their standpoint, Jesus had already spoke about the destruction of the temple and being rebuilt in 3 days in reference to his resurrection. They were confused by that. And now he's talking about the temple again being destroyed. And it seems to me that Jesus spoke in ways that were not clear about his death and his purpose and so on until towards the very end, but just before his crucifixion, when he became more clear about what he had in mind. So, and I think from a historical standpoint, and perhaps biblical, and I'm not sure that those first century Christians, many of them thought that the end of time was going to be within their generation. They were confused by that, and it's not surprising then that, you know, having Jesus right there in front of them to teach them, that they were confused, that we, in a Christian, you know, the vast Christian community, that we're confused today.
We can sure get confused, and when you're talking about prophecy, probably nobody has any future prophecy totally understood, except the prophecy that Jesus is coming back. That is crystal clear. And to add to maybe their initial confusion is verse 34. This generation shall not pass away until all these things be fulfilled. If we understand all these things are referenced back to all the signs of for the destruction of Jerusalem, that makes sense. But if you take that to the end of time, they would have thought that it would have happened. And I think probably many of them were surprised that Christ didn't return in their lifetime. But I believe Jesus often taught in ways that weren't crystal clear to the people at the time, but as you said, as it got closer, the parables. I don't think most of those parables made any sense to them fully until the church was established, and then they'd say, well, that's what he's talking about with the mustard seed. And then it just blossomed out. And they understood that at the right time, but not necessarily clearly at the time it was articulated. Mark?
Yeah, I was just going to follow up on that. That's, you know, in Acts 2, they get the Spirit. You know, so Matthew 24 is written really for us. I mean, we can look back on this and see, hey, you know what? Jesus was a true prophet because he prophesied that things were going to happen before they did, and we look back and we can see that they happened. Yeah. So it's not a matter that they had to know everything here, but I think if you read through this chapter as a whole, and a lot of times we kind of divide it up and so we get confused, if you think about it as a conversation, I think it can make a lot of sense, and he is really adamant about that. The first thing you're talking about, two things here, people. The first thing is you need to be clear about when that's going to happen and even be prepared to escape. And you should know about it because you've listened to your prophet Daniel already tell you when this is going to happen. He even refers to Daniel about that. But then, and I like in verse 5, you referred to that earlier, it says, for many will come in my name saying, I am the Christ. And he's talking about, but that's not the time yet. And then he talks about the destruction of Jerusalem. But then he says after that in 23, then, so after the destruction of Jerusalem, If anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there, do not believe it, you're still not supposed to believe it. Because this, that's the destruction of Jerusalem and the time when Christ is going to come back are not the same times, and that's the point he's trying to make.
Absolutely.
And the rest of the chapter he spends saying, and you're not going to know about this second time. The first time, you should be prepared, but the second time, no one knows when that's going
to
happen.
I think verse 23 that you amen. I think verse 23 that you're referring to is it would have been natural when Jerusalem was besieged for them to have thought, well, okay, this is it. He's coming.
Yeah, I think.
And he's saying in verse 23, it's not it. It's not it.
Right. And I think that's the reference in verse 28 when it says a lot of times people take 28 about the vultures, the eagles being the Roman emblem, but I just think 28 means that wherever the carcass is, whenever people are downtrodden and tired with life, you know, people come in and say, hey, it's the end of time, and I'm a prophet, and follow me. And I think that's what they're saying in verse 28, that when you feel like it's the end of time, because Jerusalem has just been destroyed, you know, vultures are going to come in and take advantage of you. Don't let them take advantage of you.
And to tie this back to Tom's previous comment, they may not have understood a lot of this for a long time, but as I recall, the Roman army didn't just come and besiege in a day. It surrounded the city for an extended period of time. And these people may then have gone back and reread this or rethought this and said, hey, remember Jesus said, get out of town when this is happening. And off they took. And I think that's probably what happened. So it made a lot more sense to them in probably AD 67 and 8 than it did in AD 31 or 2.